Welcome to Busy Gamer Podcast 66. We publish BusyGamerNews.com, a gaming site for people too busy for gaming sites. And this podcast offers highlights from our site's reviews and feature articles short enough to enjoy during even the shortest commutes.
If you want the week's game releases, comprehensive DLC summaries, and our latest giveaways, visit BusyGamerNews.com. In the podcast, we'll share just our latest gaming adventures in audio form as often as we can.
This episode is our first-hand coverage of PAX Prime 2011, from our first listen of Borderlands 2 to our surprise find of the show, Retrograde, plus some interviews with game musicians Darren Korb, Chainsaw, and Jonathan Colton.
Pretty much every PAX, we find something cool we weren't really looking for. Last year, it was Rascals. This year, we stumbled onto a great new use for our guitar controllers.
Retrograde is a reverse rhythm shooter. So the idea is you're a super spaceship pilot and you beat all this giant battle. And so you finish the battle and then all the explosions cause damage to the space-time continuum. And so now time is flowing in reverse. Since time is reverse, you basically have to undo all your actions in the previous battle. It looks like a shooter playing in reverse, but it's actually more of a rhythm game because you have to basically unfire, which is timed to the beat of the original music we've had composed for the game.
You don't have to use a guitar. You can use a regular controller. But it's definitely fun to play it this way, though a bit different from playing a song in Guitar Hero or Rock Band.
You're basically changing the space lanes of the ship. We don't have chords, so it's not like you press two buttons at once. But we do have, like, enemy shots which are coming from the left and returning to the guns that fire them, and so you have to get out of the way. So it's kind of, like, more challenging to figure out your way through these enemy fires and get in the right position to undo your fire.
So do you just have to press the buttons on the guitar controller, or do you strum?
You strum is basically your unfire, and then the buttons get you in position. We also have some power-ups, like the retro rocket, the reverse time for undoing stuff. You hold in the whammy bar, and we have an oscillation overthruster that you use by tilting the guitar, and it doubles your points. I mean, some of the Guitar Hero games are just, like, super duper hard. I don't think we have anything as hard as, like, the hardest in Guitar Hero, but we do have some really challenging levels, and then we're gonna have, like, trophies, and we have challenge modes to basically add difficulty. So the actual game is great for busy gamers because the levels are basically one song, and all the songs are around 4 minutes. And so if you use your retro rocket and reverse, you know, maybe a level will take you like 5 or 6 minutes to beat. But basically the entire game is split up into these little chunks.
Another unexpected find was Joe Danger the Movie. The original Joe Danger was a PlayStation Network exclusive stunt fest. The sequel looks to be more realized and potentially available on more platforms.
The idea of the game is that you're like a Hollywood stuntman and you're on the scene of a movie, right? And it's one big movie, but you play all the individual scenes. You might be on a mine cart kind of trying to escape from a crumbling cavern, or you might be sneaking into a military base and trying to shut down some missile silos and then escape.
Is this a sequel, or would you say it's more using the IP in a different direction?
I hope that we're trying to do something different. I mean, our whole idea is, in Joe Danger 1 on PSN, we were very constrained as a team because there was just four of us making it. And, we put everything we had into it. With this one, we kind of have the engine already, and we could just focus on gameplay, trying something different and taking risks. In the first one, you were just kind of a traveling stuntman, you know, in the desert on your motorbike, and there was a lot of similarities maybe between the levels. It was still a very, you know, popular game, but it wasn't the kind of game that we wanted to make, if I'm honest. You know, we wanted to do something much more expansive, and that's what this is. So in this one, variety is kind of the key thing. We want every level to have either a different environment or a different vehicle or a different gameplay type.
Yeah, I saw jetpacks and motorcycles and mine cars.
Yeah, mine cars. I mean, that's just what we're showing, skis. That's like a very small portion of what we've got, but it's kind of what's working at the moment. So this is very early on in development for us.
It looks quite polished for what you have.
Well, it's very nice of you to say. And yeah, I mean, it's good. People seem to be liking it, which is always nice. But we don't consider ourselves as a kid's game or a casual game. You know, we consider ourselves bright and vibrant and colorful, but actually deep gameplay is what we're about, right? And the games that I grew up with as a kid were things like Mario and Sonic and all the Sega games, all the Nintendo games. And they were basically the hardest games you'll ever play, but some of the best games you'll ever play, right? And that's what we're, I guess, inspired by, or what we aspire to, right?
It's kicked my butt.
A lot of the levels that we're showing at the moment are like short, so they're like 30 seconds long, right? They're very challenging in that you'll replay them quite a lot, but equally you can sit down with our game booted up and have played a level in like less than a minute and set a high score kind of thing. That's what we're all about, is that if you've got 30 seconds free, you should be able to get into the game and play it, you know, and hopefully you're still there like 2 hours later, even though you didn't intend to be. But, you know, we have other levels that are longer, and also the levels start to combine and intertwine. So you might nail one scene early on where you're maybe chasing down a van that's escaping from like a bank robbery or something like that, right? That's one of our levels. And then later on, you chase like the bank robbers who burst out of the back of that van. You start to play longer and longer scenes.
So the scenes that are in this particular game, will they eventually interstitch into a movie that you can watch?
Yeah, that's the thing. They start to, I mean, don't get me wrong, we're not trying to like create the greatest narrative ever told or anything like that. It's a funny story that'll hopefully like raise a smile, but it does all form together into one film, and you are filming each one of those scenes one by one.
We heard quite a bit about Orcs Must Die from our PAX East correspondent, Colin Moore.
Pretty much orcs are buzzing in your castle, and you need to keep them away from this portal. And the thing that makes it really interesting is very quick and fast-paced. So when you pick it up, it plays like an action game. You have a crossbow, and you have a sword and stuff, and you can just walk up and kill them. Every time you kill them, you're given money, you're given loot to be able to buy traps.
So we simply had to try it. It's much more action-y and less strategy-focused than it sounds.
The first time I've seen it up close. Cool. Well, it's Orcs Must Die is an action strategy game. It's also got tower defense elements to it. So you'll start on a level. You'll see that orcs are trying to get from one side of a level to another. And you have to stop them by, like, choosing to put down traps. But you're also down inside of the world fighting with swords and spells. So it's a really high action game.
Yeah, I wasn't expecting the first-person action perspective. I'd heard a lot about it, and I was thinking tower defense over the isometric view, maybe. Or
no, you are down in it. It's totally an action game from that perspective. So it's got a lot of physical combat to it. But you can also take it the route where you've got a high strategy component, too. So you have to do the planning. How do you want to set up your traps? Are the traps being effective? Yeah, there's 25 different levels to the game. It's all totally cool, different geometry.
Cell phone games still don't get a ton of exposure at PAX, but we tried to broaden our horizons by taking a look at the location-based game Life is Crime, which is out now for Android and coming soon for iPhone.
Just released our first game on the Android market. It's called Life is Crime. It's really built around your routine, so you can game places you go every day, coffee shops, banks, bars, complete missions, move up leaderboards, and really push your criminal career forward.
The game will find your location. We built a customized map so the world feels like a game. And then we populate buildings with game art based on the categories, so coffee shops and restaurants, and so it just draws it around you. And then we hand make the landmarks. So for Seattle, you know, you got Space Needle and the Benaroy Hall and so on. So you can perform missions and you can drop contraband, which is part of our sort of moving virtual goods to share with other players. So you can do that within a 500-meter radius of where you're stood. But you can fight anybody. So I can fight the guys who are currently battling over the Space Needle. I was looking at that earlier. So I can fight at any distance, but I can only deal contraband and do missions within 500 meters. So if you're in the coffee shop, you're bored waiting for your coffee, you can like do the missions. You can also do a few other things. You can fight people to own your local coffee shop, to get on top of that leaderboard. You can call your dealer, virtually, of course. You have this briefcase that you carry around with you all the time. and you can buy things and store it in there.
It's free to play. Monetization is through virtual goods and consumables in the game.
Are those things you can pick up normally anyway, but you can get them faster if you buy them?
Right.
Girl Got Game indulged her Jones for comic video game crossovers by visiting with a Dark Horse rep there to introduce their new line of Mass Effect comics and an art book.
Our first series, Redemption, came out shortly before Mass Effect 2, and then now we're heading into our third Mass Effect series, Mass Effect Invasion, in October, and we just sort of built it up from there, title by title. It's a real pleasure to work with BioWare on all of their titles. Star Wars The Old Republic has been a lot of fun, as has Mass Effect, and we're just starting to discuss and develop a Dragon Age comics program. You know, an important part of why these have been successful for us and why they're so fun to work on is that we work directly with the developers on all of our comics to tell canonical stories, to extend in a very meaningful way the narratives that are being built in the games. So on all of our comics, the lead writers, the art directors, the executive producers are all directly involved with the stories we tell and how we tell them.
Can you tell me a bit about the Mass Effect that's coming out in October?
It's definitely a lead-in to Mass Effect 3. I don't know if I'd call it a prequel. It's kind of its own story in and of itself. It follows Ariat Sloak, the Pirate Queen of Omega, as she defends the station against an onslaught by these Reaper-created monsters. Cerberus gets involved. Things sort of fall apart from there. It's really exciting, and it definitely gives readers a taste of what's going to be going on in the galaxy when they pop Mass Effect 3 into their machines. We're announcing at this show that we're doing a book called The Art of the Mass Effect Universe. It covers concept art for all three games, hundreds and hundreds of images that have never been seen before, really incredible stuff that we were first exposed to while we were developing the comics using this material for reference, and we thought, well, it's such a shame that people don't get to see this stuff. So it's going to have commentary by the Mass Effect developers, has an introduction by art director Derek Watts and executive producer Casey Hudson. It's going to be a really beautiful package, and it's going to be coming out in February, the month before the game. So give people a real sneak peek at what's going to happen in Mass Effect 3.
Our 8-year-old Pikachu fan found a new way to enjoy Dungeons & Dragons games in one of the unlikeliest of places, Facebook.
Today we're looking at Dungeons & Dragons Heroes of Neverwinter. This is based on the 4th edition Dungeons & Dragons system. It's a really deep turn-based combat, so when you're building a character from 4 races, 4 classes, customize your appearance, choose your gender, and then as you're leveling up, you'll pick up all kinds of powers and gear that will change the look of your avatar, also kind of customize the way he plays. It is a single-player game, but there's a lot of social functionality, so you can bring your friends with you into the dungeon in your party. They won't be controlling their player, but they'll get gold and experience. They can also go into what we call active spectator mode, which means that they can watch what you're doing in the dungeon, open a little chat dialogue to give you encouragement, or if you've got that kind of friends, they can mock and taunt you for your failures. But the good thing is they can also kind of give you little heals and buffs. So if you're doing a really hard dungeon, they can help out. We actually have 50 dungeons in the game at launch. Each of those has a normal, hard, and heroic difficulty.
5-0?
5-0, yeah. That said, the amount of content is really unlimited because there is a dungeon workshop that allows players to create their own content. It's a Facebook turn-based RPG going into open beta this month in September. You can check it out at www.facebook.com/heroesofneverwinter.
We also found a kindred spirit, a busy gamer turned developer.
This is Vessel. This is a liquid physics puzzle game. The core of the game is this liquid simulation we've made, and we use it to create creatures. So you have creatures that are formed out of this simulated liquid. And so they keep all the properties of liquid. So like these creatures can melt themselves, they can reform. Again, if they lose a limb, they can flow in a new limb. Different liquids in the game. We have lava, we have this glowing goo, all these different kinds of liquids, all these different kinds of creatures. So you got this grid of possibilities that you can do. A certain kind of creature can have a certain kind of effect. And so that's where a lot of the puzzles come from. Like you make a creature out of water, make another one out of lava, you have them collide, and then naturally they're going to just make steam. We've kind of designed the puzzles to have, like, they're very easy to physically do. The hard part is, like, making that mental leap to figure out, okay, how do I need to think differently to do this? And that they all kind of revolve around giving life to this inanimate liquid, bringing life to matter.
How does it save? Is it something you can play in short bursts, or do you have to play through for a long period? Or
Ah, yes, you guys are busy gamer. I actually relate to that a lot because anytime, like, I always hear games that brag, like, well, we got 80 hours of gameplay. I'm like, oh, God, I'm going to stay away from that. I don't have that kind of time. There's no filler in Vessel. It's not like mindlessly collecting anything. It's all about, you know, making you think. It definitely works in short bursts, and it's something that you can really focus gameplay, I would say. We don't waste time. That's something that I've consciously made an effort to do.
The time you waste is basically your own trying to make that mental leap.
Yeah, it's good. It's time well spent. It's like considering the implications of these rules that we set up, the consequences of these actions. And there's like underplay to the story as well. Like you're creating these creatures that are somewhat alive. You know, what does that mean? Kind of morally, that's kind of an undertone that goes through the game.
If you love Portal, there's a good chance you'll like Cube, a puzzle game that's very much in the same vein, minus GLaDOS, of course.
Cube is a first-person puzzle-solving game set in an environment full of white cubes. The objective of the game is to get from point A to point B. You're like a kind of guinea pig in this enclosed world. You basically go through each puzzle, and then later on, the kind of world breaks down, and you've got to escape from this place.
So it reminds me a little bit of Portal, like those test chambers.
Yeah, a lot of people say that. The aesthetic's quite similar as well, but the gameplay is quite different in what you have to do, basically. So each cube has a different function. Red cubes can be pulled out and pushed in. Blue cubes can be used to launch the player. And yellow cubes come out in sets of three. The one that you fire at first will come out the highest, so you can use them in different combinations. And then you'll come across the green cube, which can't be directly manipulated with the gloves. Instead, you have to push it around with other cubes, or you can bounce it up with a blue cube kind of thing.
If old-school games are your thing, but you don't have time to endure their old-school difficulty, Retro City Rampage might just hit the spot.
So it's kind of like Grand Theft Auto meets Super Mario meets a whole celebration of the 80s and video games. More than Grand Theft Auto stealing cars and shooting people, you can use power-ups, crazy weapons like a bionic arm and a light gun and proton pack-like thing, and you can jump on guys like Mario to stomp them for points and coins. So you can do pretty much everything you want, everything that you could think of from the previous days of gaming in this huge open world as a criminal. It's all in a cartoony style like Looney Tunes, so hit people with your car, they fly across the screen and stuff. So it doesn't really feel like it's such a conscience killer like Grand Theft Auto is. It's not as difficult as the retro games were, because I want people to enjoy it and go through the whole experience in the story. So I've added a lot of checkpoints, for example. So one, things aren't as difficult because you can just replay a shorter chunk. And in addition, it gets rid of the tedium. There's no driving all the way from point A to point B and then failing a mission and having to do it again, which is something Grand Theft Auto does a lot of. You can save anywhere. So again, unlike Grand Theft Auto, you don't have to find your hideout to save.
I was really drawn to this physics puzzler called the Splatters, though, truth be told, I wasn't terribly good at it, but there was something oddly soothing about it.
At the heart of it, you're a splatter. You got a short life, and your goal is to kind of die with style. So what you want to do is you want to splatter these guys, and you want their goo to kind of cover up the bombs down below. So to do so, what you're going to want to do is you kind of aim with the left stick, and then you're going to want to fire with the X or B button.
Oh, that's what I was doing wrong, okay.
Yeah. When they hit a solid object, they're going to pop. Goo's gonna go down, and look at that. Just like that, you're right through the level. With all these mechanics on the surface, looks like a nice little easy game, and it is nice and accessible, but it's very deep, and it's gonna be a huge leaderboard runner, and lots of social features to be built in, and kind of egg on that high score system, ability to see replays, and it'll be coming early next year.
Another old-school classic reborn, Sonic Generations promises something for both old and new Sonic fans.
Sonic Generations is our game for this year to help celebrate Sonic's 20th anniversary. For the first time ever, you get to play as both classic Sonic and modern Sonic. As classic Sonic, you get to use some of his classic moves and play in 2D environments that have been completely reimagined from eras past. So our game covers the last few years of Sonic, both the Genesis era, Dreamcast, and modern. So as classic, you're playing in 2D side-scrolling, and as modern Sonic, you're playing every same levels, but in 3D. It's coming out November 1st for the next-gen platforms and winter for 3DS.
If you own a Kinect and have been lamenting the lack of grown-up games for it, well, Sega wants to talk to you about a little thing they put together called Rise of Nightmares.
Rise of Nightmares will be the first mature-rated Kinect title. It's also kind of the first story-driven title on Kinect. The whole game is just filled with undead creatures, not just humanoid creatures. Like, we have brought back to life little jester style like marionette dolls. The chapters in the overall act, each individual act, you're looking at like 10 to 20 minutes or maybe even 5 to 20 minutes. So it doesn't wear you out. The first time I played it, I found myself playing for 4.5 hours. Yeah, our producer Sam Mullen at Sega came down and he's like, dude, you made it through about 40% of the game. And I was like, oh my gosh. I was like, I'm really impressed. And I'm like, I'm really sore. Like,
so bad. How long would it take to beat the game?
Well, I'm a completionist. I'm somebody who likes to explore every nook and cranny. I actually like went through and picked up a lot of the stuff. So it took me on my playthrough about 9 hours and 45 minutes. If you want to just gun it through without killing things and just get from point A to point B, it'll probably take you about 6 hours. But we're not going to confine you on Kinect to a rail-based kind of system. You're able to explore each act or each level as you would however you wanted in any other third-person kind of game.
So how do you navigate them?
I've been telling people it's like a deranged hokey-pokey. With one foot planted, you put the other foot in front of you, and how far you slide your foot out determines how fast you go. So if I use that same foot that's far stuck in front of me, foot and put it behind me, I can walk backwards or forwards. And all the turning is turning at the waist and using your shoulders. So whichever shoulder's forward, say I turn to my right using my waist, that left shoulder is facing forward, so the Kinect will measure that, and it'll turn you right. There's no like leaning involved, so when things get really crazy, like there's blades coming at you and like a ton of undead, you don't have to worry about like leaning back. You can just step back from them.
Last year, we totally missed Duke Nukem Forever, which was locked away behind a 4-hour line most of the show. We weren't going to make the same mistake this year with the sequel to our 2009 Game of the Year, Borderlands, so we were 4th and 5th in line to see it on the first day and recorded full audio of the extraordinary demo.
When we looked at Borderlands 2, we knew we wanted to look at every piece of the game. So we, of course, you guys probably remember, with millions of guns, we're so excited! So we really enjoyed what we did with Borderlands, and the procedurally generated weapon system worked out really well. But what we felt that we would like to do more of is more visual diversification in style and gameplay. Bandit weapons. So you guys remember in Borderlands, we had the bandits spread around Pandora, and they were fending for themselves, building shacks like you have the one over here. But it was kind of funny, is we actually didn't have them building weapons in Borderlands 2. We thought, well, they probably should. Now you see the bandits, that when they build weapons, you look at this thing, it's built of just bits and pieces. You look down the scope there, you see it's just nuts and bolts. It's kind of like the style of a bandit. Now, these guys are not engineering masterminds, so you're not going to see major technical things. What bandits know is lots of bullets is lots of fun. So what the bandit's weapon style is, you see that clip? He's got 72 bullets in that clip. So what the advantage of the bandit is that you just don't have to reload nearly as often. We want gamers to experience more weapons in Borderlands 2. And you don't do that by just saying, hey, please try all the guns out. You do that by rewarding them. So what we have is situations like that where the TDR is popping the shield back and then he's actually switching to another gun to finish the guy off. Oh, wait, we got a skill tree. You leveled up. Perfect. Look at that. We worked on the UI a lot. So what we wanted to have a better experience in Borderlands 2 was you get into that split-screen situation. You remember when you're doing the skill tree and you're like, f***ing scroll thing. So if you look at this, you can imagine. So now we have this vertical system where it worked better in split-screen situations. You imagine when you have a PC, you'll actually be able to, you know, click on skills. Imagine that. We want the experience with the UI to be much more natural and work better in more situations.
Kill this constructor so we can get the hell out of here.
So Roland, Lilith, Mordecai, and Brix are now all back in Borderlands 2. They are now NPCs as a part of the story. Now you saw Adam dual-wielding assault rifles there. You can actually dual-wield any two weapons that you want in Borderlands 2. So you can be submachine guns, shotguns, sniper rifles for whatever reason that you're into. Alright, so what you guys probably noticed by now is this is a moving quest item. What we've done in Borderlands 2 is we wanted everything you do to be more connected to the story and to the world. So we actually done a couple of things to accomplish that. Firstly, we took the lead designer and lead writer, we tied them up and put them in the room together, so they're actually working in the same room for the duration of Borderlands 2. Now, secondly, we needed to give them better technology to enable that. So we've actually reworked the questing system to enable things like, say, this moving quest item. We want more situations where you feel like an adventure. We want you to go from point to point to point on a forward motion thing, and less of a situation where it's just, oh, I'm going to fetch something return, fetch for something returned over and over. We want it to feel more organic. Now, I mentioned the AI working together, so we wanted to put this example for you guys. You see the badass warlord, he actually called in for help and reinforcement there, and you have these surveyors that came in to start healing him. What we have is situations where we have AI now actually complementing each other and have different functions. So those surveyors, they'll come in and start healing, and when they're done with that, they're turned to a more reflective situation where they're actually, you shoot at them, they'll bounce bullets back at you. You have other guys coming who actually help amplify damage, things like that. We want the player to actually start making tactical decisions in combat. It's more of a situation where you look at the entire battlefield and you figure out what you need to do, and less of a thing like, oh, this guy's closest to me, I'll shoot him. We want players to actually think about their battle a little bit more. We want to reward them for doing that.
Will Borderlands 2 be our 2012 game of the year? That's a long way off. We have to admit, it's a distinct possibility.
With so much going on, it's increasingly hard to tear ourselves away for the PAX panel discussions. One that did get our attention was the BioShock Infinite session, where creator Ken Levine and actors Troy Baker and Courtney Draper revealed some of the methods used to create the game's lead characters, Booker and Elizabeth.
Promise me that if it comes to it, you will not let him take me back.
We had really painted ourselves into a corner on BioShock, because if people are familiar with, you know, the twist where you learn who Jack is and where he came from, the fact that he was sort of that, you know, he's this cipher who is by design a cipher. We couldn't really go back and make another game, honestly, where you were a cipher, because originally, because I think the first question people would be asking is, okay, who's he really? You know, who is this guy? That really left us with a problem. And I think that whenever we have a real problem, we always try to say, okay, well, what's the opportunity in this problem? And the opportunity we found was, let's go against what our instinct is, and let's really try to embrace character in the storytelling. Because, you know, if you look at BioShock 1, it's basically a museum piece. You know, you're in Rapture after it's fallen apart and after the party's over. And we said, well, what if in this story you were the catalyst for what happens in Columbia in a lot of ways? And what that meant is, okay, well, if you're a catalyst, you have to be sort of a living, breathing person. And that's where Booker DeWitt came in. And then if we wanted Booker to have a character to interact with, you know, we had an idea to have this woman, Elizabeth, in this story, but we never really thought about the kind of what that would mean in terms of building a relationship between the two of them. And in fact, for a long time, both Booker and Elizabeth were silent, because we were, you know, it's that thing like you're hanging over the precipice, but you don't want to make the jump. And for a long time, people would say, well, Elizabeth would say this. I'm like, no, she's not going to say anything. She's not going to talk. And then I realized that was just not going to be, that was not a sensible thing to do. And it would be a missed opportunity. And so we just started talking about, well, what would it mean to be a person, to be Booker, and to have this person with you and do it in a way that people hadn't really seen before. And, you know, and that started a very long and challenging, probably the most challenging process in this game is Elizabeth and Booker.
Ken and I have had several conversations about this. You know, when you take an FPS, it's also an RPG, and then which the whole point is to be this immersive experience. But then when you give that first player or first person character a voice, you can be, sometimes you can, and I've seen it happen before, to where you actually pull the player out of that experience, because I wouldn't say something like that, I wouldn't do that. So here you have a narrative and a huge story that you're trying to convey. And you also have a character that is incredibly stoic. He's the strong, silent type and never says anything without thinking about it first. How do you convey that kind of emotion and intention without seeing the face? You know, and a lot of actors give you the eyes, you know. And you can't do that in this case. You've got two hands. And what was really cool was, you know, I told Ken, I was like, this is really ambitious. Are we going to be able to pull this off? And it was really cool because he's embraced this phrase and drilled it in my head of draining the swamp, of just pulling any of the ideas that you think you need to compensate and just really trusting it. Because the benefit and the asset that we have in this is we have Elizabeth there to really sell the fact that Booker's taking a second on this decision. He doesn't know what to do. He's scared. He's awed by what she just did.
So the way we work this is, you know, usually when we did System Shock and BioShock, I never met any of the actors on BioShock. I met them over the phone, and we would just do, basically, I'd be sitting there in a conference room on a speakerphone, and we would have the actor in New York or in LA, and I'd be directing them over the phone, and they had the script, and I would do some rewriting on the fly. I had a fair amount of rewriting on the fly, but it was, by nature, it wasn't a very intimate process. And with Booker and Elizabeth, we decided very early on that we would need to get to know each other. So we actually flew Courtney and Troy out, and they actually they sat next to each other on the plane and really got mm-hmm. to know each other. So by the time they came in, they already had understanding of each other, they knew each other, which you don't get a lot of opportunity to do.
And that, we were in a space of...
Oh my God, that room was so small.
4 feet by 5 feet maybe, 6 feet by 5 feet. We were close. We were real close. And so when she's looking up at me, I am literally,
right in front of my
face. Right in her face. And it got, we're able to look at that now and laugh, but it was awkward.
This was really awkward. This was the callback.
Not all panels are winners. the Halo 4 reveal was mostly a dud, leaving more questions than answers about what will be included in the first game in the second Halo trilogy.
I think it's really important that fans experience the story and all the surprises, you know, at the appropriate time. And so we're really, as much as we would love to share some of those details with you, we just have to hold back.
There was one small reveal, if you were patient.
Yes, there's going to be a bunch of stuff. I mean, the Arbiter is featured in Glassland somewhere. Spoiler.
I really had to see the Elder Scrolls V Skyrim demo. Todd Howard from Bethesda did not disappoint as he showed off new features and even took down some dragons with the game's various spell powers.
So the right trigger does your right hand, left trigger does your left hand, and you can use the D-pad here to hotkey items. And it really is, you are what you play. So if you want to be a magic casting guy, just put a spell in your hand. You can dual wield those as well. So you can put that spell in either hand. What's cool is if you pull both triggers at the same time. You'll get a more powerful version of that spell. These are the Guardian Stones. These are some of the standing stones in Skyrim that you can find and help further define your character. So you can only have one of these blessings at a time. I'll show you guys some of the interface here, something we spent a lot of time on. Because in a role-playing game, you're going to spend a lot of time looking at your stuff. And our artists have made and detailed thousands of items. A really nice system for sorting it. What's really cool here is, you know, you can spin them all around, take a look at them. And this stuff carries over to magic as well, so all of the spells and shouts you can learn, you know, all of those become a visual, and then you can mark these as favorites, like you do web pages. And so when you see me using the D-pad, I'm actually cycling through the favorites I've already set. Probably our favorite menu is the skills, and this is the idea where you look to the heavens, and this is going to show you how your skills have been progressing, and then there, you don't pick a class, so every skill affects your leveling. The higher the skill, the more it affects it, and then when you level up, you get to pick a perk. And what's really cool is each of these constellations is its own skill perk tree. This is the local tavern, good place to pick up quests, and we do have a new quest system that will actually generate random quests for you to perform, as well as tweak individual aspects of quests. Dragons are our big boss creatures. Other than how they enter the scene for this demo, they are completely unscripted. They have a lot of really, really cool behaviors. We're ecstatic with how they turned out, and excited for when you guys play the game, just how you're going to fight them and what they're going to do. This guy's a frost dragon. He's a lot tougher. I'm going to use that dragon soul I absorbed to unlock Stormcall. This one is a high-end shout that lets me call a storm that rains lightning on my foes.
Do you want to hear more? We have the full, uncensored audio from these sessions, except Halo 4, though we can totally post that one if you really want, plus the PAX Media demo of Borderlands 2. Look for the link in our show notes.
I set my sail, fly the wind, it will take me back to my home, sweet home.
One of the highlights of PAX 2011 was meeting up with some of our favorite video game musicians. Darren Korb wowed us with his score and songs from the video game Bastion. So we just had to find out where this amazing music came from.
I'm curious about how you got into game music.
I actually lucked into it. My buddy Amir was one of the co-founders of Supergiant Games, and he just kind of asked me to do all the audio for him when he started his company. And, you know, we've been friends since we were kids, and I've been a musician and a producer and composer in, you know, other areas before this. So this is actually my first game.
So you were in the band Furley?
Yep.
So was that your first big band or?
Yeah, well, it wasn't big, but it was actually Amir was in that with me. It was called, when we were in high school, it was like our high school band. It was called Icarus at the time, and then we kind of moved to New York, and I called it Furley, but it was the same thing. I've been in some other projects since. I was in a band called Audio Fiction for a little while. I played bass for them, and I produced a record for them.
So where did the music from Bastion come from?
I was lucky enough to be involved really early on in the project, and so I was able to take some of the ideas that we had really early about tone and vibe and feel and kind of what we wanted to accomplish in that regard. And I was able to try and transmute that into something. And I had some goals, some restrictions for myself. You know, I didn't want to do something I'd heard before in a game, really. I wanted to do something that was more eclectic than that, because I felt like at the time you either hear kind of electronic stuff or orchestral stuff or like rock or some combination of that. So I wanted to do something that pulled from other influences, a little bit more kind of world sound and folk and blues, and you know, also with like the trip-hop beats. And so I kind of set up a genre for myself, which I call acoustic frontier trip hop. So like, as long as everything fits in that genre, I thought, you know, I'd be able to make music that is connected without being samey or repetitive. The vocal pieces, I looked at a lot of different stuff. I mean, Zia's song in particular, I looked at a lot of like kind of old Southern spirituals and stuff like that. And, you know, kind of blues-based stuff. And another big influence on the music in general and the vocal songs as well, kind of some of the more acoustic Led Zeppelin songs, like from Zeppelin 3 and stuff like that. And, yeah, I mean, you know, Jeff Buckley and things like that are a big influence on me, Radiohead.
Matt Chainsaw Cheney is Twisted Pixel's secret weapon. He takes their quirky games up a notch with his frequently odd but always entertaining musical interludes.
Everybody loves donuts. Lord knows how to.
I'm very interested in your music because it's different from a lot of video game music. It seems, I hate to use the word frivolous, but it seems like it's lighthearted and fun, and I always kind of gravitate towards the music that makes me laugh and it entertains me.
Oh, thanks a lot. I appreciate that. Yeah, I don't take myself too seriously at all. I just want to have fun with our games. And the whole dev team, you know, just a bunch of silly guys. We just have fun with what we're doing. And I really don't have any musical training or anything, so I have no idea what I'm doing. I just throw stuff against the wall and see what sticks.
So how long have you been doing game music?
Game music. Actually, Comic Jumper was the first game that I had written music for actual gameplay. Like, Donut Song Explosion Man was the first piece of music I ever got in a game. And then in Comic Jumper, I did the gameplay music for the first level. So before that, it was just all sound design. I was mostly a game sound designer.
So you did the Brad theme and...
Yeah. Yeah, I did the Brad theme and Captain Smiley's theme and the stat screen song in Comic Jumper.
Just sit back and relax, take a look at all them stats. You serve it, a busy boy, haven't you?
Gunstringer just went gold, so we're ready to put it out the door. Right now I'm working on some DLC for that.
So did you do music for Gunstringer?
Yeah, I did almost all the music. I outsourced music for one of the plays to a company in Georgia called Audio Aggregate. But I guess I probably did about 70% of the music in the game. And it's a style of music I've always wanted to do. I've always been a big fan of Ennio Morricone and like the Spaghetti Western soundtrack style. Had a lot of fun with it, and I hope people like it. There might be a surprise in there. I don't want to show all my cards yet.
So something maybe towards the end of the game?
Or a little sooner than the end.
We stalked the Jonathan Colton table in Bandland for 2 days, hoping to snag an early copy of his new album, Artificial Heart, produced by They Might Be Giants' John Flansburgh.
Just as we were giving up hope, Joko showed up lugging a large box and consented to a short interview while he signed my CD.
I'm just curious about how hard it was to write a sequel to Still Alive, basically, or a follow-up to that, because that was such an iconic song for people.
Yeah,
right?
It was kind of daunting. I felt better once I realized it was never, ever going to possibly, it just couldn't be as good as the first one. I mean, even if the song was a better song than the first song, there's no way it could have had the same thrill and impact that it had the first time around, because the first time around was the first time around. So once I had accepted that it was not going to be as good as the other one, it was much easier to write.
Yeah. How long did it take?
You know, not long. Once I actually buckled down and started doing it, I was done in a couple of days, really.
By my only friend, oh, did you think I meant you? It would be funny if it weren't so sad. You have been replaced, I don't need anyone.
till I stop feeling so bad.
On Twitter, we encourage you to follow Game Watcher and Girl Got Game. That's GRRL Got Game. We often tweet news that isn't big enough to deserve an entry on the site or has a very limited shelf life. We also have a BGN community Twitter list. If you're not on it and want to be, send Game Watcher an at reply. We also encourage you to join our Busy Gamer News Facebook fan page.
If you use Stitcher Radio, search for Busy Gamer and favorite us there. And if you enjoy the podcast, please like us there too. We're also on Zune Marketplace, and we'd love it if you rate and review us on iTunes.
Some of the music in this podcast came from Mevio's Music Alley. Check it out at music.mevio, that's MEVIO.com. You can find details and links for these and other songs at busygamernews.com/WAG podcast.